Thanks for tuning in for the February 16th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature interview is with authors of a study to assess the frequency of biologically defined Alzheimer's disease in relation to sex, age, APOE4 status, and cognitive impairment in a prospective cohort of patients studied with amyloid PET and tau PET. In our What's Trending segment, you'll hear the third part of our four-part series update in epilepsy.
This is Greg Day from Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Joseph Thériault, a PhD candidate at McGill University in Montreal, fellow Canadian, and lead author on a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Frequency of Biologically Defined Alzheimer's Disease in Relation to Age, Sex, APOE4, and Cognitive Impairment. Joseph, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
Your paper discusses clinical and biological findings in over 300 community dwelling participants who came to your center and had comprehensive cognitive assessments, genetic testing for APOE4, a common risk variant for Alzheimer's disease, as you know, and molecular imaging, which included amyloid and tau PET imaging. First question for you, what's the difference between biological AD and the markers that we use for that, and how we normally think of Alzheimer's disease in the clinic environment?
So in 2018, the National Institute of Aging and the Alzheimer's Association put forward this research framework in which Alzheimer's disease is now defined by the accumulation of two pathologies, amyloid beta and hyperphosphorylated tau. So what this has done essentially is this has extended previously the neuropathological definition of Alzheimer's disease, which has been in place since 1997, and it has moved it to living humans with the use of in vivo biomarkers of amyloid and tau. So in the biological definition, Alzheimer's disease is no longer synonymous with dementia. In this research framework, it's possible for individuals who don't have any cognitive impairment to have Alzheimer's disease. But it also highlights the other side of the coin in which there's this possibility that individuals with a clinically diagnosed probable Alzheimer's disease don't have Alzheimer's disease biologically.
That's a great summary. So basically, for those of us in practice, if you have biological Alzheimer's disease, you've got some changes in the brain, but don't necessarily have clinical symptoms. If you have the clinical phenotype of Alzheimer's disease, we hope, if we're correct, that you have Alzheimer's disease pathologically, but I guess that's not a guarantee, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Why don't you talk me through the key findings from this great study?
Our study looked at the association between age and Alzheimer's disease biomarkers, so amyloid and tau PET. When we looked at age, we saw that the vast majority of individuals under the age of 65 were negative for Alzheimer's disease biomarkers, meaning that they had neither evidence of amyloid nor tau pathologies. Older individuals, whether they were cognitively impaired or not, were more likely to have biological Alzheimer's disease. For example, in our cohort, in individuals age 75 and over, 40% of the individuals in our study had biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease. When we look at the effect of the APOE4 allele, which is another very important risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, we see this remarkable pattern in which people without the APOE4 allele, only 20% of them had biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease, whereas in individuals carrying one APOE4 allele, approximately 40% had biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease. And finally, in individuals with two APOE4 alleles, nearly 80% had biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease. Another main finding of the study is that depending how you define biological Alzheimer's disease, between 7 and 12% of individuals without any cognitive impairment in our study had biological Alzheimer's disease, according to this research framework. So these are individuals that, when they were evaluated by dementia specialists and neuropsychologists, there was no evidence of cognitive impairment. However, they had biological evidence of Alzheimer's disease. The flip side of this coin is that about 85% of individuals who were clinically diagnosed with probable Alzheimer's disease by the dementia specialists at our center had biological Alzheimer's disease. So 15% had something else. And finally, the last main finding is that clinical evaluation by dementia specialists and neuropsychologists systematically underestimated the frequency of biological Alzheimer's disease at all ages.
That's a great summary. And so if I've heard you correctly, your sample includes people that are cognitively normal, don't have any complaints, and don't have any deficits recognized by experts at your center, but it also includes people who have cognitive impairment, and then works to define Alzheimer's disease-related changes using these molecular biomarkers in that cohort.
That's correct.
Let's delve into that a little bit more, and let's, for the beginning part here, let's focus on individuals who had cognitive impairment. So those who had symptoms that might be characterized as mild cognitive impairment or dementia. You talked a bit about risk factors in that cohort for Alzheimer's disease changes on the molecular biomarkers. What were those key risk factors if you were going to order them for those of us in the clinic who are often really trying to prioritize etiologic assignments or diagnosis in the patients that we're seeing who come to us with memory complaints?
That's a really good question. So one of the interesting things here is actually the risk factors for individuals with cognitive complaints and those without cognitive complaints for biological Alzheimer's disease were the same in our cohort. So the most important ones were the APOE4 allele, which I mentioned earlier. So for example, 80% of individuals in our cohort who were homozygous for APOE4 had biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease. Age was the second most important risk factor, with increasing age being related to increased risk of having biological Alzheimer's disease.
Very helpful, and particularly nice that we have an easy biomarker or easy clinical biomarker, which is age, which of course we're routinely measuring in all of our patients and can help us to assign risk. From your perspective, thinking about those that are cognitively unimpaired, so those who are otherwise normal or don't have symptoms, but had biological evidence of Alzheimer's disease, what does that mean from a clinical perspective? Does that convey something related to risk of symptom development in this cohort? What can you say to that point?
So this is one of the most interesting aspects of the biological Alzheimer's disease research framework, for me anyways. Like you said, by definition, these individuals don't have overt cognitive impairment, or at least any cognitive impairment that was detected by the dementia specialists or the neuropsychologists working at our center. However, there's some very interesting research emerging from our group and from others, which provides evidence that individuals who are at the highest risk of cognitive decline and cerebral metabolic dysfunction in the future are the ones who have biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease. So even though they may not have cognitive impairment now, these are the individuals who are at highest risk of cognitive decline in the future. And what's interesting with this is that this really fits with the most accepted disease model of Alzheimer's disease, in which Alzheimer's disease is considered this disease that accumulates over 20 years or so in the absence of symptoms. So in which amyloid and tau are accumulating in the brain, but only result in symptoms maybe 20 years after this process has started. So some researchers refer to these individuals, these cognitively unimpaired individuals who have biomarker evidence of Alzheimer's disease, as preclinical Alzheimer's disease. So we don't know for sure whether every single one of them is going to develop Alzheimer's disease, but we know that these individuals are at much higher risk of developing cognitive impairment in the future.
Thanks for talking me through that. One of the findings in your paper that was of most interest to me was that while age is a risk factor for biological Alzheimer's disease, the concordance between biologically defined Alzheimer's disease and clinically defined Alzheimer's disease seemed to drop in older individuals. Why do you think that is?
That's a really interesting point. What that means to me is that there are some very old individuals or some older individuals, let's say 75 and up, who are at much higher risk of having biological Alzheimer's disease, of having amyloid and tau, because these two pathologies are related to age, but they may not yet have developed symptoms. So these are individuals who are cognitively unimpaired, and they have the highest risk because of their age. They have higher risk of having amyloid and tau, but they have not yet begun the neurodegenerative process that might result in cognitive impairment in these individuals.
Got it. And just to be clear for our listeners, 75 and older doesn't make you very old, but we can enjoy that phrasing within a specific research context.
That's right.
So getting back to this issue of concordance, if we look study-wide, as you said in your sort of opening review of key statements, the concordance between clinically defined Alzheimer's disease, those are patients with symptoms who are thought to be due to Alzheimer's disease, and the biological definition of Alzheimer's disease, so positive biomarkers, was good, but not perfect. And I think one of the most interesting things in this sample is that 85% of people who had a clinic diagnosis of dementia thought to be due to Alzheimer's disease didn't have consistent findings on biological markers. So what that would mean, I suppose, is 15% of people in your cohort who the doctors told them that they had Alzheimer's disease had something else. What is that something else in those patients?
That's a really good question, Greg. The short answer is that they're likely to have a neurodegenerative disease that is not Alzheimer's disease. The long answer is that without biomarkers that are specific to these other neurodegenerative processes, our study was not able to identify the etiology of dementia in these individuals. So aside from Alzheimer's disease, as you know, this progressive amnestic dementia phenotype that we call probable Alzheimer's disease can be caused by a number of diseases, including hippocampal sclerosis, limbic predominant age-related TDP-43 encephalopathy, which is now known as LATE, and neurofibrillary tangle predominant dementia, among many others. So without in vivo biomarkers specific to these processes, it's underdetermined what specifically is causing the progressive amnestic cognitive impairment in these individuals. In other words, what we've been able to do is rule out Alzheimer's disease as a cause in these individuals.
That's a good way of looking at it. And I think it seems clear from the follow-up that you provided from your patient, from the characteristics, that the cause, while it may be undetermined in this sample, probably wasn't one of those causes of dementia that we consider treatable. And that's an important take-home point for clinicians as well.
That's right.
How does this finding in your cohort using these in vivo biomarkers, how does that compare to some of the other cohorts in the literature, including those that use neuropathological findings, so followed patients to death?
That's a very good question. The biological and clinical definitions of AD have always had varying degrees of sensitivity and specificity, and there's never been perfect agreement between the two. In fact, that's why they use the term like probable Alzheimer's disease for the clinical definition, right? So a lot of previous studies similar to ours compared in vivo diagnoses to autopsy, like you mentioned. So one of these is a multi-center study from 2012 from Beach and colleagues, this one that's cited pretty often. And that reports a positive predictive value of 81% for a clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease for neuropathologically defined Alzheimer's disease. So the results of that study are quite close to ours. But there are some important differences too. The individuals in our cohort were a fair bit younger than individuals who are followed up until their death. And so correspondingly, because of their lower age, I think they have lower rates of Alzheimer's disease pathology than some of what we see reported in neuropathology literature. Another interesting finding from our study that fits well with some other population-based cohort studies was that in every age group, the rate of biological Alzheimer's disease was higher than the rate of clinically defined probable Alzheimer's disease. So this finding was also observed in a 2019 paper from Jack and colleagues at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester.
So, and to that point, I guess it gets back to you, what you said early on about how we have a tendency probably to underestimate the contributions of Alzheimer's disease in the clinic environment, more so than overestimating it. Would that be accurate?
It's partially that, but it's also partially that it's essentially impossible to detect Alzheimer's disease without biomarkers in individuals who don't have symptoms. And I think that's one of the big takeaways from the study is that by definition, preclinical Alzheimer's disease doesn't have any symptoms. So catching it clinically is pretty tough.
And I suppose one could say, what's the impetus for catching it clinically if it's not causing symptoms? But as you know, and as our readers are increasingly knowing, that our hope is to be able to treat this disease early on before it causes symptoms, which again is some of the value of these biomarkers.
That's exactly right.
As we close our time together, recognizing that this access to these molecular biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease are becoming a bit more widespread. So the FDA here in the United States has approved various PET measures that can measure and track amyloid in the brain, as well as most recently in May, tau. And even more recently, we're learning about potential access to blood-based biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease. What lessons from this ideal research cohort examined in a very specific and very intentional way, what lessons from your work should we be translating into the clinic when it comes to trying to interpret and understand how best to use these available biomarkers?
That's a great question, Greg. I would answer that question in two different ways. So the first way in which I would want to answer it is in the care for patients who have cognitive impairment. So in these individuals, whether it's amyloid imaging or tau imaging, they can both be tremendously helpful for either ruling in or ruling out Alzheimer's disease as a cause of cognitive impairment. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, this has some implications for how you care for the patient. So for individuals with cognitive impairment, it's a great way to understand what are the causes. In individuals without cognitive impairment, or maybe with who are just starting to have some kind of concern for their memory, I mean, we're not here yet, but if we look a little bit further to the future, I think there's some hope of perhaps either selecting the right individuals for clinical trials. So if the hope is to treat Alzheimer's disease in individuals who have not yet developed symptoms, if you can find individuals who are either amyloid positive or tau positive or both and enroll them in a clinical trial, they are the individuals who stand to benefit the most. And looking a little bit further down the line, it could be a very helpful way of, when disease modifying therapies are available, to use them in the right individuals at the right time.
Thank you, Joseph, for taking time to discuss your findings, in particular for that big emphasis on how we can extend these molecular biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease to improve our diagnostic and potentially even therapeutic approaches to our patients. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Joseph Theriault, lead author on the paper Frequency of Biologically Defined Alzheimer's Disease in Relation to Age, Sex, ApoE4, and Cognitive Impairment. This is definitely a paper that you can and should read in this week's issue of Neurology.
Hey, everyone. This is Fabio Nascimento with the Neurology Podcast, and I'm back for week three of our What's Trending in Epilepsy. We encourage you to listen to weeks one and two, where we discussed simple febrile seizures, epileptic spasms, genetic generalized epilepsies, and self-limited epilepsy with centrotemporal spikes. This week, we're having the pleasure of talking to Oren Devinsky from New York University, and we'll be discussing the diagnosis and management of focal epilepsies in the adult population. Oren, we're super excited to have you here with us today.
Thanks, Fabio. My pleasure.
First thing I wanted to touch on is, since we're talking about adults, we all know that adults typically have focal epilepsies, and the most common type being a temporal lobe epilepsy. So how do patients usually describe their temporal lobe seizures as?
So it's a good question, and it varies. Many patients will present after they've had a major convulsion. And only then, on taking a history, do you discover they've had deja vu with a smell or a dreamy state. And so many times patients present with temporal lobe epilepsy with a convulsion, and you have to dig in and get the history of focal aware or unaware seizures.
And how specific and how reliable that semiology is when you're talking to them, Oren?
It's an excellent question. And the truth is, I think it's less specific than most neurologists believe. So we did several studies on temporal lobe epilepsy patients and looked at their auras and compared them to generalized epilepsy patients in interviewers who were blinded to the diagnosis. And shockingly, generalized patients have many auras too when you ask them. So part of it's confirmation bias. But I think it's the constellation of features. So if you get deja vu with a smell, with a rising stomach sensation, and it lasts for 30 seconds, and it precedes impaired awareness, bingo, you've nailed it.
That's super helpful. So let's say you get a good history, you're leaning towards epilepsy and temporal lobe seizures, and you decide to get an EEG, a routine EEG. How's that helpful, and how frequently do we see abnormalities on the EEG?
It will depend on the patient and depend on the duration of the EEG. In patients with definite focal epilepsy, like temporal lobe epilepsy, the standard routine EEG, if not sleep deprived, may only capture some abnormality, focal slowing or focal sharp waves or spikes in 50% of cases. When that is a sleep deprived recording or a 24-hour to 48-hour recording, the yield should go up towards 70 to 85%. So sleep deprivation, prolonged recordings will definitely increase the yield.
And what about the etiologies of temporal lobe epilepsy? What are the most common ones that we need to know about?
When someone's diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy, certainly the most important diagnostic test, perhaps after the EEG, is the MRI scan. And the MRI could pick up any structural underlying cause that could cause temporal lobe or other focal epilepsies. Mesial temporal sclerosis is a common finding and would be quite specific for temporal lobe epilepsy, but any blood vessel abnormality like a cavernoma or AVM, a tumor, whether it be a benign hamartoma to a malignant glioma, any of the inflammatory disorders, whether it be an autoimmune disorder like lupus or sarcoidosis, could show up as causing epilepsy. And of course, the less common autoimmune encephalitides. So there's really, I think, the full range of etiologies, as I like to say, anything that could affect or negatively impact the brain structure or function can cause focal epilepsy.
And as good clinicians that neurologists are, we always like to know the etiology of what we're treating. So that's kind of a natural response. But in real practice, how does knowing the etiology change management, if it changes at all?
I think it changes it a lot. Number one, patients really like to know what's causing their epilepsy. And I think as a neurologist, we should know too. But if they have, for example, mesial temporal epilepsy with sclerosis, then that tells you they're probably going to be more difficult to control with medications. And if you did get control and you tried to get them off meds because the patient said, hey, doc, I'm seizure free for 2 years. Can I get off the darn medication? Well, for that patient, if they've got mesial temporal sclerosis, their chance of relapse is much higher than someone who has a normal MRI. So I do think understanding the etiology really can inform treatment decisions.
Now we made the diagnosis and we're starting an anti-seizure medication for a patient with temporal lobe epilepsy. What are your go-to anti-seizure drugs in this scenario and how do you pick the right one? And I know there's a lot in that question, but can you just tell us about the most important take-home points about best matching up the anti-seizure drug with the patient?
Yes, and I'll share some recent findings from the UNE Epilepsy Project 1, which is a study of relatively recent onset focal epilepsy, so very relevant for the kinds of patients neurologists will see in their office. And not surprisingly to everyone listening, levetiracetam is often the first drug these patients are treated with, either by an emergency room physician, by a neurologist, or an epileptologist. And I think the reason is that it's easy to use, there's no drug interactions, the onset of efficacy is typically within several days. So it's a good drug in that way. The downside, of course, there are side effects. I'd say at least 15% of people will get troublesome mood issues or lethargy. But a bigger issue that was uncovered in HEP1 is that when you look at these patients after 6 months or a year, a very large portion of those on levetiracetam will have switched to a sodium channel agent because they didn't get the efficacy they were hoping for. And it looks like sodium channel agents, whether it's lamotrigine, lacosamide, carbamazepine, oxcarbazepine, are probably more effective in most focal epilepsies for the average patient than levetiracetam. Now, there are exceptions to that rule, but I do think it's a good rule both from my clinical practice and I think now from some objective prospective studies.
Very interesting. Now, if we fail to control these patient seizures and they become drug resistant, now, what's the next step in management and what therapeutic options would we have at that point?
So at that point, it's a good time to go back and rethink the question you asked before. Is it good to have information about etiology? And so, of course, the answer is yes here. If you have a structural abnormality, a cavernoma in the temporal lobe, mesial temporal sclerosis, an area of focal cortical dysplasia in the right frontal lobe in a right-handed individual, those patients, if they've now failed, let's say, two anti-seizure medications chosen appropriately for the right syndrome and used at the right doses, that patient should be considered for surgical therapy probably after two failures. If they have a surgical amenable lesion, that could be readily identified because their chance of a cure may be 80% or even greater, whereas the chance that more medications will work is a progressively diminishing curve.
When you're seeing patients, again, with focal epilepsies in the adult population, but they're not temporal lobe, they're affecting other lobes, such as the frontal lobe, occipital lobe, or parietal lobe, how does that change your management? How do you think differently, and what should we be mindful of when taking care of those patients?
So for the extratemporal epilepsies, Fabio, my own view is medication-wise, there's really no difference. I think focal epilepsy is pretty agnostic on medication. And to the best I'm aware, there are no studies that clearly show this drug works better for focal epilepsy from the frontal lobe, but not the temporal lobe. There are old lures from when I was training as a fellow that some drugs like phenobarbital work better for seizures coming from primary motor cortex, but I'm not sure any of those are really scientifically founded. But I do think it comes into play when you're thinking about either a resective surgical procedure or a neuromodulatory approach like responsive neurostimulation. And certainly for epilepsy surgery, you want a lesion or a seizure focus to not be in a really critical functional part of the brain, like the motor cortex, like the language cortex, or a visual cortex, where if you remove the seizure focus, you're going to cause harm. And that gets to be a more significant issue when you get towards a lot of the frontal lobe areas, especially if there is not a lesion. So if you're dealing with a patient who has a normal MRI and the EEGs implicate frontal lobe epilepsy on the dominant side, those patients are not great surgical candidates because, you know, it can be hard to localize the seizure focus, and removing large portions of the dominant frontal lobe, in my view, is likely to do more harm than good.
Switching gears to other types of therapy now, we hear more and more about CBD in clinic, and I know we're still discovering and understanding its use and role in epilepsy, and it's a huge and vast field. Can you just give us a few important points that we all should know about in terms of when and how to use CBD for patients with epilepsy?
A great question. I think the published data for which we have really robust scientific evidence is in Dravet syndrome, Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and tuberous sclerosis complex, for which there's good evidence on the dosing and the efficacy and the safety. When we move away from those three rare syndromes, we're flying by the seat of our pants, in my view. Simply, we don't have good scientific data on CBD, and we have almost none on THC. But for generalized epilepsies and for focal epilepsies, the jury's out. And if anything, there have been a few studies on focal epilepsies with CBD that have not shown terribly impressive efficacy. So I think we really desperately need more information. Some of my epilepsy patients feel CBD can be helpful for anxiety and sleep. And I do think it's a fairly safe medication, although it is a drug. It does affect the hepatic cytochromes, and it does cause some significant drug interactions, especially with clobazam. So certainly, if it's being used, it should be used with the neurologist's knowledge, and the neurologist should look up the potential interactions and counsel the patient.
Can you tell us the points we must cover every time we're counseling your patients in clinic about an epilepsy care in general? I know it's also a pretty vast question, but what are the points that you have in the back of your mind and you should cover every time you see them?
I think perhaps the most important thing is to stay general at the beginning, to ask people about how they're doing, you know, and broadly about their quality of life. And if they can, to inquire about their mood, because depression can occur in at least 30% of people with epilepsy and often is the most significant driver of poor quality of life above and beyond seizures or anti-seizure meds. Not what I would have intuitively thought, but we've studied it, many other groups have studied it, and we all find the same thing. I think for women, once they enter reproductive age after puberty, I think issues related to pregnancy should be on the neurologist's mind, at least starting to counsel women about the potential effects of meds on pregnancy, the potential need for folate or multivitamins, and just the awareness that, you know, women often become pregnant when they're not intending it. They could be adults dating, they could be married and not planning on children. But I think for any woman of childbearing age, pregnancy should be on the mind of the neurologist and at least discussed at some point.
And do you talk about sudden and expected death in epilepsy or SUDEP, Oren? And how do you approach this very delicate topic with your patients?
So Fabio, as you likely know, SUDEP is an area of active research for me. But unfortunately, as an active clinician seeing a lot of people, it's a part of my epilepsy life. And in the past week, I had two young adult patients, 24 and 27, die from SUDEP. So it happens. It's part of every neurologist's life, whether we know it. And I think it is absolutely critical, not on every visit, but certainly every patient, and I try to do it within the first few visits, to counsel them about SUDEP. Now, listen, if someone only has focal aware seizures for the past decade, it would be a very light discussion and something they can just be aware of. But for people with more active seizures and intermittent tonic-clonic seizures, it's absolutely mandatory that we not just discuss it, but go over the factors that this is in the patient's control. If they take their medicines, if they get good sleep, if they avoid excess alcohol, they can dramatically reduce their risk of SUDEP. The vast majority of people who do die from SUDEP had not taken their last dose of meds. Many of them are found to have non-detectable or subtherapeutic anti-seizure medication levels. So it is an excellent point you made. And if I could leave the neurology community with one message, don't forget about SUDEP. You can save lives. You can really save lives with just basic education.
This has been great, Oren. We really appreciate all your teaching. All the listeners and all the neurologists out there, I'm sure, are very grateful. And welcome again, and thanks for being with us. And you all that are listening, thank you so much. And we hope you learned as much as I did today. And see you next time.
Thanks, Fabio. All the best.
Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on equity, diversity, and inclusion, global neurology, and innovations in care delivery. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.